This episode of Racks, Fur, and Feathers is brought to you by Red Bud Liquor at 3213 West Front Street in Buchanan, Michigan. The largest selection of liquor and craft beer in the area and the coldest beer in Bucktown. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back. So today's episode, we sat down with Dr. Bastian, who is formerly associated with the LSU Ag Center. Dr. Bastian has been in the media quite a bit lately. He's the one who has the theory that chronic wasting disease is spread through a spiroplasma bacteria, not a prion. So we got a hold of him a couple weeks ago and scheduled this episode, and we had some technical difficulties.
This is one of the weirdest episodes we've done on some equipment that we're not entirely familiar with, and we had some issues.
So what we're going to do is narrate what we asked and then cut into his audio. And then, so you guys are going to hear a lot of splicings, but I think it'll be a good listen.
It'll be full of information that you guys want to hear about. It's just going to be in a little different format than what we're used to. So here we go.
All right, so our first question for Dr. Bastian was, we asked him about his background in neuropathology.
I originally received my medical degree from University of Saskatchewan, Canada, and trained in neuropathology at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. I was a neuropathologist at University of South Alabama in Mobile for almost 20 years. I also was at Baylor College of Medicine here in Houston. Actually, I was the only neuropathologist in the city at the time. There's not many of us.
This is where we asked how long he's been researching chronic wasting disease and other TSCs. For those of you who don't know what TSC stands for, it's transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
My initial work was regarding Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and I found the bacteria in a brain biopsy by electron microscopy in 1976. That gives you an idea. Published that data in 1979. The chronic wasting, I've received some material when I was at Tulane Medical School in 2001, and we were able to isolate the bacteria from those tissues my tenure at Tulane Medical School.
Next, we asked him if he could briefly go over what the mainstream science thinks is the infectious agent or what causes the disease, and then to share with us what he's found in his research and his recent breakthrough.
Well, we've gone a little bit beyond a theory. Prion theory has been out there since I published my article in 1979. Prusser published his prion theory in 1982. The prion theory is based on a replicating protein. And obviously, the Pasteur showed that proteins don't replicate. So the prion is an amyloid protein. And basically, you can get an increase in the amount of the prion protein by self-assembly, as amyloids do. And it's just been misinterpreted as proliferation. We've really shown what's called Koch's postulates with my work. The big breakthrough came in the past 12 months, where we've been able to culture the organism out of TSC tissues, chronic wasting disease, and scrapy brain affected tissues. And this is a big breakthrough because basically it allows us to complete Koch's postulates of causality, or it's called, it's a scientific evidence of identification of the causal agent of any microbe, of any bacterial infection. And basically, over the years, and I've shown the association, first this association, there's four postulates. And basically, I've shown the association, but also we could culture the organism in 100% of cases. So the second postulate relates to culturing in the cell-free media, and we've done that in the past year. Then you take that culture and inoculate into a normal animal and produce the disease. We've done that. And then you re-isolate the bacteria out of the experimentally inoculated animals, and we've done that. So we've completed Koch's postulates of causality. We've been able to clearly show that the spiroplasma, and it's really a novel spiroplasma organism, that we've been able to show that it is the causal agent of these diseases. Basically, into a broth culture, it actually grows on a broth culture, then you can put that onto an auger plate. If it grows as colonies on auger, that is the gold standard for microbiology.
This is where I ask him if the same strain of bacteria was found in all these TSCs. So here's what he had to say.
Yeah, we've been able to isolate the spiroplasma from chronic wasting disease in deer, from scrapie in sheep and goats, and we've been able to isolate it also from tissues infected with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So yes, so far with the material that I have available, we've been able to isolate it in all instances.
And this is where Ray Cole asked him what led him to believe it was bacterial and not caused by misfolded prions, and if he was ever on the prion bandwagon.
I've never made sense of the prion wagon. You have to deal with this with common sense, and nothing makes sense. Besides, Dr. Manuelides at Yale has spent much of her career showing that the prion amyloid has nothing to do with infectivity. Unfortunately, they're interpreting the prion as the cause, but it's useful in postmortem material to make a diagnosis. But as far as being the cause, that's an error.
This is where I ask him what exactly a protein is. I don't know if he couldn't hear me or if he misunderstood the question, but he does clarify what an amyloid protein is, and it definitely doesn't mean it's made up of amino acids, like my dumbass thought.
It's an amyloid protein. For example, there's a great deal of interest right now in Alzheimer's disease being a bacterial disease, and that stems from the fact that Borrelia is a large spirochete associated with Lyme disease. And in tissue culture, it will produce tau and A-beta, which are the two amyloids associated with Alzheimer's disease. Now, a group at our place have shown that spiroplasma in tissue culture produces alpha-synuclein. And the alpha-synuclein is the prion associated with Parkinson's disease. So it's very exciting possibilities here. But again, these proteins are amyloid proteins, just like the prion. The prion's an amyloid protein. It's just a marker. Amyloid proteins are misfolded proteins.
This is where I mention how exciting it is to think about all the doors that have been swung wide open into the unknown because of the doctor's breakthrough. Again, this is a huge step forward for diseases like ALS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and many others. And what he had to say was pretty interesting.
Well, as far as CWD, it's very exciting because it seems to open a huge door into the unknown. And basically, once you can grow it in cell-free culture, then you can produce antibodies. You can use those antibodies to produce serological tests. You could potentially set up vaccines, so forth. So it's opened a major door for research. What I'm encouraging is that those people, you know, they're working in the field now, that they take this ball as well and get as much. The CWD problem is huge, and we've really got to attack this in a big way. The ability to grow it is exciting, and this will allow us to actually potentially handle this problem.
I asked him how far away he is from realistically creating a vaccine for chronic wasting disease.
I think an injectable vaccine now is quite possible. For example, you know, what animals are in danger? Well, you know, deer breeders have captive animals, but what about the cattle population? You know, the experimentally CWD has been transmitted to cattle. Potentially, you could immunize your cattle. You could immunize your captive deer population. And what about zoos? Most of the animals, the big cats, as you may know, that mad cow disease, which is the same disease, was originally described in cats in England. So potentially the big cats are susceptible, as well as apparently it's in camels, and apparently the giraffe is related to camels, etc. So, you know, immunizing your zoo populations would be very important.
I briefly touch on how important the cure is, not just for the deer that we all hunt, but for the variety of animals in zoos and on farms and things like that that will be affected by what he discovers.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, epidemiology is important. We need to know where it is in nature. For example, in grasses or in soil, you know, how is this spread? And basically, we can grow the organism out of soil or grasses and prove our point by doing that. That's quite possible down the road.
So this is where I mentioned that in his press release from the LSU Ag Center that I mentioned that he was within a year or two of developing an affordable chronic wasting disease test kit that hunters could carry with them in the field. I asked what exactly affordable means, $20 or $100, and how the test would work.
This would be something the hunter would carry in his pocket, and basically would be an immunological-based test. And basically, what you do is put a drop of blood probably from the kill, the animal, and put it on this test. Basically, if it's positive, you don't even dress it. If it's negative, you can take it home and, you know, consume the venison with no worry. The fact that we can make an antibody, we can make that test fairly soon, actually. There are companies that, you know, that make these things, and all they need is the right antibody. We can make that. And as far as price, well, I've talked to hunters, and obviously they would pay $15-$20 a test, you know, and that would be significant to support the making of the test.
Spend a moment talking about if there's been any confirmed CWD cases in humans, and more specifically, did they get that from eating the infected venison, or did they pick it up some other way?
Well, the only thing I can say about that is that, and remember, I'm a neuropathologist, MD. I've dealt with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease much of my career. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is a horrible disease. Patients usually die within a few months. And usually healthy individuals up to then. But it usually affects people between the ages of 40 and 80 years of age. When you start seeing teenagers, et cetera, coming down with this, you worry about a more virulent form. The new variant disease related to mad cow disease in England showed that specific pathology indicating a more malignant form. It's interesting that the pathology of chronic wasting disease in deer shows that same pathology, suggesting it's a virulent form already. It's a very dangerous form of the agent. And in that sense, it is worrisome. And in fact, there have been a few cases of CJD in their 20s in the Western states that are worrisome, maybe suggestive of being related. But what we need to do is to further characterize the bacteria. And once we characterize and do the genome studies, et cetera, genetic, you know, information related to the makeup of the organism, we can then maybe identify different strains of it and be able to trace infections from CWD to people or that sort of thing.
So I asked if someone would be able to cook the bacteria out of the meat. In episode 18 with Carrie Maurer, we asked the same question regarding prions, and the answer was no. To deactivate the prion, you would have to reach temperatures exceeding 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. So I was hopeful that we would get a different and less scary answer from Dr. Bastian. So let's hear what he had to say.
Well, that is a problem, because I know in the past we've shown that the laboratory strains of Spiroplasma are resistant to 85 degrees centigrade. When you do a roast, for example, you only get it up to about 70 degrees centigrade. So that's very worrisome. E. coli are killed when at 80 degrees centigrade. So killing it by heating is potential is a problem. We have to get it out of the out of circulation. We have to test animals and develop vaccines so we can get rid of that reservoir of infection in the animal population.
Okay, so by the way, 85 degrees Celsius or centigrade is 185 degrees Fahrenheit. So just for a point of reference for you people. Here I asked him if and when he comes up with a foolproof vaccine, has there been any thought of how to administer it to the wild deer and elk population?
That is going to be interesting. As you may know, I'm a neuropathologist, so I think we need a little help from the wildlife biologist to figure that out. But basically, protein look box may be a possibility. Darting may be a possibility, but we need a lot of help from our colleagues in the wildlife community. There's a certain hysteria associated with all of these diseases, and basically, if one understands what's going on, then you can deal with it much better and actually understand and protect yourself.
At this point in the interview, I kind of take a minute to illustrate the importance of educating people about CWD in order to help them, even non-hunters, understand how dangerous this disease is and try to encourage more of a team effort between state and federal agencies and, you know, John Q. Public in general. Brent kind of chimes in there saying that he thinks the increased resentment towards wildlife agencies from hunters comes from a lack of understanding of the disease and the fact that there hasn't been a really big social impact on the population of people that would care the most about it. This is because the disease takes years to not only kill the animal, but also it's usually years before the animal shows any sort of symptoms of the disease. And I think that it's more important that people are aware of the possibility of this disease making a species jump into humans or cattle. And if that were true, then there would be more of a concern and definitely more of a concerted effort to understand this disease and to get it taken care of.
So this is where Ray asked the doc why he thinks other labs are so reluctant to look into the bacteria possibility.
I think the problem is that the prion has been established as a, you know, as its own language in the sense that most people don't understand what they're talking about. The fact that one protein stumbles up to another and causes replication, that's all conjecture. And basically, it's not been shown. It's a theory. I know some scientists have said, well, it's not been replicated. Well, who's tried? You know, hopefully, I believe some established laboratories are going to replicate this. And once we get that done, then let's go forward big time. We got to go in the right direction.
Here we asked if it's been difficult to get funding for his research because of the fact that his research is going in a completely different direction than mainstream science.
Well, because basically the people working on the prion have sat on all the review boards, and as a result, getting money from the NIH has been quite difficult. I think right now the initial monies will probably come from private sources like Deer Breeders Association, Deer Hunters Association, etc. So once that happens, and once we get experimental models out there that we can validate all these tests and vaccines, then I think you'll see a lot more funding agencies come on board.
At this point, I asked if there was any way the public could actually donate to support his research, or if there's a platform that we could use to actually funnel some funds into what he's doing to kind of help him along the way.
Well, I do know I have a small nonprofit that's called Fund for CJD Research, and surely glad to accept donations. But the group in Pennsylvania are doing an extensive campaign to look at funds, and they're quite willing and interested in supporting my efforts. I guess it's surprising that someone like myself can be so focused to work on something for 40 years. But I was at one meeting, a professor from actually Israel was saying that I've never seen anybody so focused on anything in my my lifetime. So I guess I have that reputation.
So Ray asked, how good does it feel when it all comes to fruition? It's a big word for us.
Nice.
Well, I think if it hadn't been for the epidemic of deer, the whole thing would have died on the vine. But there probably wasn't even any interest in what the cause was. But basically, I think this is going to sort out. And it's especially important in humans, with the chronic CJD. For example, a patient with a diagnosis of CJD, it's a death sentence. Well, wait a second. If this is a bacteria, let's look at it and think about antimicrobial treatment. There's a lot of new stuff out there, bacteriophage therapy, so forth. So, I mean, it may not be a death sentence anymore. Maybe if you catch them early enough, you'll be able to save these people. And these people become sick in the prime of life, So, my gosh, I think this, we got to be in the right direction. There's a lot of talented people out there in many fields. And once they get into this, I think it's going to roll.
Ray points out the fact that Dr. Bastian has not found the prion present in every TSE case, only about 90% of them. But the Spiroplasma bacteria has been discovered in 100% of the cases. So here's what Dr. Bastian had to say.
I think the door has been swung wide open now. And I'm hoping as many scientists as possible jump on on this. And the faster we can get a stop to these processes, the better.
In this case, we point out the fact that social media and the digital world has helped or is starting to help bring the CWD problem to the public's attention. In order to fix a problem, you have to first realize that there is a problem, and now his research that he's been working on for 40 years is finally getting some much-needed attention. His work could truly change the world, and I think he realizes that. We were beginning to as well.
Well, it's worldwide now, too, with CWD. It's in South Korea, Canada, big time in Canada. An interesting thing, and I published this recently, 15% of Alzheimer cases, they also have what's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Now, that's fascinating to me, and it surely pushes the idea that, wait a minute here, maybe Alzheimer's is bacterial. And I know the researchers that are working on Alzheimer's disease are now looking into a bacterial etiology. And obviously, the therapies related to amyloid proteins associated with Alzheimer's disease have failed. Hopefully, something's going to happen with the Alzheimer's cases as well, with their focusing on bacterial infection as being related to those diseases.
So here is where Adam asked the same question that Ray did at the beginning of the show, which was, what made you go with the bacteria theory instead of the prion theory? I think you actually asked him, did you ever have an oh shit moment or something?
Yeah, but it was like the light bulb moment where things kind of clicked and he realized that everything he's doing has a much broader meaning to it. He can actually apply this to what's going on in the real world as opposed to just doing research on something completely innocuous.
Yep. Even though we asked the same question twice, he still had some interesting things to say. So
he sure did.
Let's hear it.
Actually, before the prion theory, as I mentioned, before the prion theory was even put out, I had found this bacteria in a brain biopsy from a patient with Creutzfeldt. So I've never even entertained the prion theory. I felt that Pasteur clearly, with the well-accepted germ theory, proved that proteins don't replicate. So here, in that sense, it just doesn't make sense. This idea of proteins replicating, the idea of spontaneous generation, this sort of thing, we're all pre-Pasteur. I mean, these were the ideas out before Pasteur attacked the field and proved the germ theory. So it kind of raised its ugly head again, And I think once we, all this works out with the bacterial infection, I think the prion theory will clearly be gone, hopefully.
Here I asked if there are any other labs that are researching the Spiroplasma bacteria being the infectious agent, and if there's anybody jumping on what Ray affectionately called the Bastion bandwagon since his breakthrough.
Not that I know of. I may be the only one. But anyway, hopefully that changes soon.
Here I asked if he minded clearing the air and talking about why he's no longer associated with the LSU Ag Center.
He had a good chuckle.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, okay. I was a nerve pathologist at University of South Alabama for almost 20 years, and then I got an NIH grant, and I moved to Tulane Medical School in New Orleans. My wife is a native of New Orleans, and I'm a native of Canada, and as you can realize, if you put some winters up there, you realize that you'd try to go as far south as possible, not getting quite into Mexico. But anyway, the big problem with I had established my lab at Tulane, and then we started a working agreement with LSU Agriculture Center where we could do large animal experience. And we did some phenomenal studies there, very important studies in my, and I was working with them. But Katrina hit and destroyed my lab in the Ag Center. I mean, not the Ag Center, but the Tulane. So I moved the laboratory totally up to the Ag Center. But I was worked there. This is from 2005 to the present. I was a gratis professor. That means no money, no salary. But I've obviously been. I haven't been in this for the money anyway. But we had an apartment and this sort of thing. I probably spent a couple $100,000 of my own retirement funds living, going up back and forth to Baton Rouge. And it's probably an hour and a half trip, but it's a very rough trip, the trip up to Baton Rouge. And my wife has never liked Baton Rouge. When I got this opportunity to get funded by the group in Pennsylvania, it was an obvious thing to go ahead and move my lab back to New Orleans, which I will do. And I've been going up and working maybe 2-3 days a week in Baton Rouge. Now I could work 12 days a week in New Orleans. So, no, I just decided it was best for me and my career to move. There's a lot more opportunities developing, and I'm very excited about the move back to New Orleans. And with the support of the Pennsylvania group, we're going to move pretty fast down there, I think. So I'm very excited.
Yes, you definitely just heard him say he spent years working with no salary and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own retirement money. How crazy is that, man?
Of his own money, working for free, investing what he has saved up into finding a cure for what he believes in.
That's insane.
Right now, there's no test for CJD. There really is not. I mean, there's no reliable test. And basically, anybody that comes in with any inkling of dementia should be scanned for that disease. And if we have an immunological test, wow, you know, we can say, okay, there's an association with this bacteria. Let's maybe do some cultures on the urine or cerebrospinal, et cetera. And we can do that. I have that available now. And then, if it's positive, we initiate the antibiotic. Well, antibiotic is a problem in the sense that the organism so far resistant to all antibiotics, but that'll change when some of these big companies realize that you got to go after the organism, and they'll come up with something. Maybe not myself, but it'll be done.
So basically, we just tell him how awesome he is. It's obvious that his passion and his concern about this disease is truly genuine. I mean, who else spends hundreds of thousands of dollars of their own retirement money and works for no money? And that hopefully more labs jump on the Bastion bandwagon, as Ray put it, to help continue to break down doors and keep changing the world.
Right.
Well, that is my hope, absolutely. And I think a big amount of credit has to be given to the PA group and Dr. Evelyn for making this so visible. And I'm really appreciative of what the enthusiasm he's looked into this.
This was pretty funny. We asked him if he hunts.
Yeah.
His response was pretty funny, so here we go.
Absolutely not. My father did a little hunting, but he let me use a 20-gauge shotgun once to shoot from some ducks, and I shot and one teal dropped. One teal. I mean, it was a sizier, about an inch and a half across, you know, that sort of thing. So, no, I realized I hadn't. Well, I didn't really, you know, it wasn't my passion. Some of these hunters have a tradition in the family and this sort of thing. I mean, if we don't do something, that's going to be destroyed. And hopefully that doesn't happen.
All right. So that's the end of the show. The rest of it was just us giving them the usual keep fighting the good fight. And we appreciate him. And we thank him for speaking with us.
Yeah, we just kept over and over repeating ourselves about how lucky we were to get to talk to him and tried to let him understand that it helps us understand talking to somebody as smart as he is, you know, dealing with people like us. So we appreciate it.
All right. So as always, if you guys want to get a hold of us, go ahead and shoot us an email at racksfurandfeathers@gmail.com. Look us up on Twitter at RFF Podcast, Facebook, Rax Fur and Feathers, or Instagram, Rax Fur and Feathers. As always, all music and artwork is done by Shane Yoder from PutThemInASong.com and the Root Note Podcast. All editing for this episode was done by Mike Bussing, Brent Ruff, and Kyle's going to do a little bit too. So, and then special thanks to Redbud Liquor for providing the beer for this episode. And like we said, special thanks to Mike Bussing for giving us a hand and MBI Studios, and to Dr. Bastian for taking the time to speak with us. He's a busy guy. So
absolutely.
Next episode, we're going to be sitting down with Chris Reynolds. He's going to talk to us about food plots and some other things you could do in the off season for deer. So, till next time, everybody.
Take care. We'll see you then.